MSW Media.
News with swearing. Daily Beans, Daily Beans. Daily Beans, Daily Beans.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Beans for Wednesday, October 27th, 2021. As you know, I'm on vacation, but today I have a really great interview with the author of the book Tax the Rich, Erica Payne. And, of course, our good friend Megan Hatcher-Mays will be joining us in the second half of the show. You're really going to love it. And I'll see you at the other side of these two interviews. Please enjoy. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. Today, I'm honored to be joined by the founder and president of Patriotic Millionaires and author of the book Tax the Rich, How Lies, Loopholes, and Lobbyists Make the Rich Even Richer, which was released on Tax Day this year, which is amazing. Please welcome Erica Payne. Hello, Erica.
Hi, nice to be here.
I'm so glad that Jennifer Taub put us in touch because I am so excited to talk about everything that you're doing and the activism that you're involved in. First, can you tell us a little bit about, you're the founder and president of Patriotic Millionaires. What is that and what prompted you to start that organization?
Yes, absolutely. So the Patriotic Millionaires is a group of a few hundred millionaires who are share a profound concern about the destabilizing level of political and economic inequality in the country. And they focus their work on reforming the country's political economy so that it will deliver results that are conducive to a stable, prosperous country. And, you know, the political economy, which is kind of the intersection of the things that people think of as typically the economy, then the political decisions that really control those things, with the tax code as being one of the leading ones. Our economy is basically structured in a way, Allison, that is going to make sure that we become even more unequal, even more quickly over time. So we're already at 100-year levels of historic inequality. We believe that that inequality is the root cause of social unrest. So when you look around at how unhappy everybody seems to be these days and how the basic fabric of our country is ripping apart, we blame that in large part on inequality, and our tax code makes it worse every single day.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk about the tax code because specifically the 2017 tax bill that was passed using budget reconciliation to avoid the filibuster by the Republicans in 2017. And, you know, we just did a story yesterday about how Senator Ron Johnson had for years paid about $60,000 a year in taxes. But in 2017, that dropped down to $2,000. And I think that was Wisconsin state taxes, actually. And a lot of that had to do with the bill that he voted for, which was the 2017 tax spending bill, which is what I like to call it, and or a tax scam bill. Can we talk a little bit about some of those loopholes? And then we can maybe get into your book because it's you know, the subtitle is Lies, Loopholes, and Lobbyists. What are some of these loopholes that generously benefit rich people, but not the middle class, this particularly in 2017, but also leading up to that?
Yeah, I mean, so in 2017, Republicans rewrote the entire federal tax code. And in 2018, for the first time in American history, billionaires paid a lower effective tax rate than every single other group of people in the country. I mean, that's the first thing to understand. If you want to know what happened in that tax bill, you know, the result of it was that the following year, the richest people in the country paid a lower tax rate than every single other group of people. Now, let's say just, you know, to be very clear, a bunch of the nonsense that is in the current Republican tax code has been around for decades. But what they did is they took all of the bad problems with the tax code, they kept all of those, and then they added quite a number of terrible additional things into the tax code. And at its heart is a differentiation in the way that the tax code treats different kinds of money depending on how you make it. So let me just give you an example. If there are two people working, two couples, so we talk about these folks in the book. So say there's one couple, we call them the work cards in the book. They go to work 40 hours a week, 50 weeks a year. They bring home $100,000. Okay. Now let's take another couple. They are already rich. If they want to make $100,000, one of them goes on their E-Trade account. and sells some stock and makes $100,000. At the end of the year, the people who work for a living actually end up about $9,000 poorer than the people who are already rich. That's at $100,000. And it continues on from there. So if you make $400,000, the differentiation is around $40,000. And that's because we treat income from investments in the tax code as preferable to income from work. So currently in the Republican tax code, the top income tax rate on capital gains, which is gains from investment income, that is 20%. The top income tax rate for ordinary income, which is the income that most people understand, you go to work, you get a paycheck, you come home, you're taxed on that income, that maxes out at 37%. So basically, the Republicans, when they rewrote the tax code, they decided that investment income should basically get a 50% off coupon from ordinary income. Now, I think that that's absurd. You know, their justification is that investors are job creators, which is nonsense in and of itself, because the only real job creators are consumers who go buy products. You know, it's certainly not the investors who buy stock on any given day. When investors buy stock on any given day, they're not even, the money isn't even going to the company, right? It's going to other investors. So it doesn't even make sense there. Historically, there have maybe been a time or two where you wanted to incentivize investing in some way. That is not the case now. There are trillions of dollars sloshing. I can barely even say the word. Sloshing around all over the place, trying to find a good place to be invested. So the idea that working people should be paying twice the tax rate as regular people is absurd. Okay. So that's kind of, that's at the get-go. That's at the heart of it. But then there are all these things built into the tax code that continue that preferential treatment for wealth. And it will over time and have over time created almost a permanent aristocracy. And that permanent aristocracy is getting even richer over time, even more quickly. It's destroying the middle class, and we're building a tremendous number of people who have almost no assets at all. So one of the loopholes that we talk about in the book is a thing called the stepped up in basis. So say, Allison, that you bought a stock for $1 million and 10 years later, it's worth $10 million. If you sold that stock, you would pay capital gains, a capital gains tax on that $9 million of capital gains, which, by the way, is again, less than what a working person would pay, but be that as it may. So you would pay capital gains on that $9 million gain. Now, say that the day before that you were going to sell your stock, you died. And so that stock goes to your heirs. When your heirs inherit that stock, the basis against which the capital gains are calculated shifts to that higher number. So you bought a stock worth $1 million. You would have sold it for $10 million. You die. So instead of selling it, you pass it on to your heirs. Your heirs inherit that stock at $10 million. So say they hold it for a year and it goes up to $11 million. They'll pay taxes on that additional $1 million since the time they inherited it, but no one will ever pay taxes on that $9 million of gain that happened before you passed it on to your heirs. So the result is that multimillionaire families pass on enormous amounts of wealth to their kids, who again did nothing to earn that money except for waiting for someone to die. They pass that on to their kids, and there is a huge built-in tax elimination as that asset is transferred from one person to the next. And I mean, that's one of a million different things we talk about in the book that hopefully Democrats will address some of it as they try to deal with this reconciliation bill. But we have essentially created a two-part tax system, one for wealthy people that basically facilitates every bit of avoidance a person could possibly come up with, and then what ordinary people pay, which there's not much of a way to avoid taxes. You go to work, you get a paycheck, you pay your taxes. In fact, a super wealthy friend of mine, last weekend we were debating the tax code, as all people do when they're at a party together. And and she started laughing. She's a wonderful woman, but she actually said to me, she said, "I don't even understand why I pay taxes. I don't even work." You know, and she's living off a trust fund that she has had forever. So when she needs some money, she sells some stock. You know, and it was sort of a flippant comment, but I think that that's where we've gotten with people who have tremendous wealth. The advantages that they have and are so built, that kind of baked in the cake, that they can hardly even see them anymore. But the end result is middle-class hardworking people are holding the bag for a bunch of billionaires who refuse to do their part and spend a bunch of their money trying to get, you know, preferential treatment, the tax code and all kinds of other things that advantage them, disadvantage everybody else, and in the process attack and destroy our democracy, which is where we are right now.
Yeah. And I wanted to address something that you just briefly mentioned, which is the budget reconciliation bill and how we can correct some of these things going forward. And also how we can push back on some of the arguments that the wealthy make, either because they're intentionally trying to push back or, like you said, it's just baked in and they don't even realize it. But I have to take a quick break. Will you stay with me?
Sure.
Awesome. Thanks, everybody. We'll be right back.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
Hey, everybody, it's Allison for The Beans. Healthy snacks have a bad reputation because, let's face it, most don't taste good and, you know, they're kind of junky and they don't hit your cravings. But today's episode is sponsored by Monk Pack. They make snacks that taste like our favorite sugary treats, but with only 1 gram of sugar or less. Monk Pack keto granola bars have just that 1 gram of sugar, 2 to 3 grams of net carbs, and they're only 140 calories each. They're gluten-free and grain-free. They're plant-based, non-GMO, no soy, no trans fats, no sugar alcohols, and no high-intensity sweeteners. And while they're great for anyone following a keto lifestyle, you do not have to be keto to love these. They're so good for you and tasty. They are the perfect snack for anyone who's trying to eat better or cut back on sugar and carbs without sacrificing taste. I've been trying to eat better, and Monk Pack keto granola bars have helped because they're filling and satisfying and crunchy and chewy. Monk Pack keto granola bars have that awesome texture, that perfect snack, right? And they come in flavors like coconut cocoa chip, peanut butter, and blueberry almond vanilla. My favorite is the peanut butter right now. Reminds me of granola bars from when I was a kid. They are perfect for a quick breakfast or a snack between Zoom calls or right after the gym or a guilt-free dessert or a midnight snack. They taste incredible and you can't beat the low sugar nutrition they provide. And by shopping online, you can avoid another trip to the store by getting Monk Pack delivered straight to your door. Try it for yourself and you'll see. We have a special deal for you. Get 20% off your first purchase of any Monk Pack product by visiting monkpack.com and entering code DAILYBEANS, all one word, at checkout. And Monk Pack is so confident in their product, it has a 100% satisfaction guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll exchange the product or refund your money, whichever you prefer. To get started, just go to monkpack.com, select any product, then enter the code DAILYBEANS at checkout to save 20% off your purchase. Monk Pack, delicious, nutritious food you can count on, and we thank them for sponsoring the show. Today's show is also brought to you by Athletic Greens, the health and wellness company that makes comprehensive daily nutrition really simple. And it is hard to always eat right. I'm very busy. I only eat once a day. I drink coffee in the morning. I do not get the nutrients I need, especially now that I'm perimenopausal. I need some extra boosts. But now there's a simple way. It's called AG1, and it's by Athletic Greens. It's a category-leading superfood product, bringing comprehensive and convenient daily nutrition to everyone. One tasty scoop contains 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food-sourced ingredients, including a multivitamin, a multimineral, a probiotic, so you don't have to take a separate one of those, a greens superfood blend, and more in one convenient daily serving. It's so convenient. The special blend of high-quality, bioavailable ingredients and a scoop of AG1 work together to fill those gaps in your diet. And they support energy and focus, they aid with gut health and digestion, and they support a healthy immune system, which, as you know, is really important right now. It effectively replaces multiple products and pills with one healthy, delicious drink. It's lifestyle-friendly, whether you eat keto, paleo, vegan, dairy-free, or gluten-free, and it contains less than 1 gram of sugar, no GMOs, no chemicals or artificial anything, while keeping it tasting awesome. Join the movement of athletes, lifeleets, moms, dads, rookies, first-timers, AGs, podcast hosts, and everyone in between taking ownership of their daily health and focusing on the nutritional products they really need in the simplest manner possible. That's Essentialist Nutrition. To make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you an immune-supporting free one-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase if you visit athleticgreens.com/dailybeans today. Again, simply visit athleticgreens.com/dailybeans to take control of your health and give AG1 a try. Everybody, welcome back. We're talking to the founder and president of Patriotic Millionaires and also the author of the book Tax the Rich, How Lies, Loopholes, and Lobbyists Make the Rich Even Richer, Erica Payne. And Erica, before the break, you had briefly mentioned fixing some of these issues, like the basis issue or the inheritance tax issue, with budget reconciliation, perhaps maybe fixing some of this with budget reconciliation. My understanding, though, is it's just, I don't know what is baked into this budget reconciliation bill with regards to fixing some of these issues and closing some of these loopholes. Can you go over some of that?
Yeah. So, I mean, kind of long story short, budget reconciliation is a process that is that allows the party in charge to only have a 51 vote threshold to pass a piece of legislation that has to do with the federal budget. So as long as something that can be included in that parameter, which comes down to whether the parliamentarian allows it or not, they have a 51 vote threshold, because clearly, as divided as the Congress, as divided as the Senate is, nobody's going to get more than 51 votes for anything.
Yeah, and that's how the Republicans passed the tax bill in 2017.
That's exactly right. And so essentially, the Democrats are in the process of doing the same thing. Now, they have approved a debate around $3.5 million worth of investments. They could, technically speaking, make those investments or make whatever investments they wanted to without having the pay-fors or the revenues to back it up. Because the federal government doesn't operate like a household budget. If the federal government needs to spend money, it can spend money regardless of whether they back it up with revenues. But the political reality is that in order to get the investments, they have to get the revenues to match it. And so it gives Democrats a great opportunity to address some of the injustices in the tax code, because there is such a need for revenue in order to get these investments made to basically get us, you know, to repair decades of underfunding in general, to create a human infrastructure that will help get people back to work, and then to do a bunch of the repairs on roads and bridges and that stuff. So anyway, all of that to be said, there is an opportunity. The Congress had an opportunity to fix the tax code. Richie Neal, who is a Massachusetts congressperson from the Springfield area, he is the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. Richie Neal's committee, the House Ways and Means Committee, is in charge of writing the revenue piece of this big bill. So what did Richie Neal's committee do? Did Richie Neal and his committee do the things that President Biden asked for to pay for the investments that he wants to make? No, they did not. So, for example, Richie Neal's committee, their proposal for funding these investments from the Biden administration, number one, he maintained a differentiation between ordinary income and capital gains income tax rate. So it's not as bad as it used to be. But if Richie Neal's plan becomes law, working people in America will still pay higher tax rates than millionaire investors, period. Number one. Number two, he declined to address in any way, shape, or form the stepped up basis, or to do one of the other kinds of reforms that would have dealt with what's unrealized capital gains. If you have an investment that is growing and growing and growing over time, you only pay taxes on it when you sell it, when your capital gain is realized. So people can accumulate multi-hundreds of millions of dollars worth of wealth without ever paying any taxes on it.
And just die and give it to
and
their kids.
Just die and they don't have to give pay it yet to their kids. Because what they actually do, Allison, is when you get to be wealthy enough, everybody wants to lend you money. So instead of selling their stock, so they never have a realization event, because they never have to sell anything, because they go to their bank and they say, I'm worth $100 million. Will you loan me $1 million for my expenses this year? Right. So they never pay the capital gains rate, and then it goes on. So anyway, he declined to deal with that at all. There's one loophole that makes me crazier than all other loopholes. It's called the carried interest loophole. And it's this little tiny stupid loophole that benefits about 5,000 people in the entire country to the tune of about $300,000 each of tax savings. Okay. He did this little thing to the carried interest loophole. This is a basically private equity funds, when they invest in something, the fund managers, because of the tax code, can pretend like their ordinary income is capital gains income and therefore pay the less expensive rate, even though they have no capital at risk. So number one, there shouldn't be a differentiation between the two rates in the first place, over $1 million, which is what Biden has asked for, which is what we support. Number two, if they had addressed that, they would close the carried interest loophole. Number three, they could close the carried interest loophole altogether and tell investment managers that they're going to be treated like every other working person in the country and pay ordinary income taxes like all the rest of us and not get this preferential treatment. But instead of doing that, he did this little trick where he extended the hold time on the carry from 3 years to 5 years and then claimed he had addressed the problem. Well, private equity firms tend to hold their investments for 6 years or longer. So by moving the goalposts from 3 years to 5 years, Richie Neal basically wanted to be able to pretend publicly that he had done something. Well, anybody who knows anything about that business knows that he actually didn't do anything at all. So he has continued to perpetuate not only a bunch of egregious stuff in the tax code in general, but he also this one specific loophole that is literally nothing but corruption of public officials, period. It is a corrupt loophole that benefits a tiny number of people for no intellectually justifiable reason whatsoever. He decided to play games and pretend like he was fixing something and not fix it. I personally think that everybody in Massachusetts should be appalled. I mean, you just keep in mind, Richie Neal is ostensibly the person in the country who knows more about tax policy than any other person, aside from Ron Wyden, who's head of the Senate Finance Committee, which is the counterpart on the Senate. He knows everything there is about the tax code. And he came back and said, we're going to pay for these investments with a bunch of shenanigans. And we're not going to address the cancer at the heart of our shared experience, which is that we have a tax code that makes sure we're going to become more unequal more quickly over time.
Yeah, and I assume this has to do with donors or perhaps his own wealth. But, you know, and folks who listen to this show and to the previous Mueller She Wrote, we're already kind of mad at Richie Neal for how he handled Trump's tax returns in any case.
Well, certainly, look, he's not there's no way that one could argue that Richie Neal is working for his constituents.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just Richie Neal cannot come out and say that he is serving the people of his congressional district. He is either intellectually confused, which you don't particularly want in a chair of your House Ways and Means Committee. But if we're going to give him a pass, it must be that he is confused or ignorant of the implications of his choices. Or B, the only other conclusion is that he has become corrupted in some way, you know, because what he did and what he put out of his committee is unacceptable.
Yeah, agreed. And we need to keep pressuring him as this reconciliation bill moves forward. One final question for you, because I get this question a lot and I hear this argument a lot. And this was actually Ron Johnson's argument as to, you know, why it's OK that he paid basically dirt in taxes in 2017, 2018. The argument is, well, the rich people pay 40% of the taxes in this country. So that should just be enough.
Well, first of all, that's ridiculous because they pay. Of course, they pay more taxes. They have more money than anybody else. That's first of all. But second of all, you have to think about money differently than how ordinary people think about money. People think about money as a dollar is a dollar is a dollar is a dollar. That is not actually true. Okay, if you don't have any dollars, a few dollars is a whole bunch of money to you. If you, there was a study that came out a couple of years ago that the average American could not come up, that I think 40% of Americans could not come up with $400 in an emergency. So we know to at least 40% of people in this country, and it is higher than that, $400 is real money. I mean, to regular people, $400 is a reasonable, I mean, that's a decent amount of money, you know? To a wealthy person, the people like our members, $400 is essentially a quarter in your pocket, if it's even that. And that's because the more money you have, the less each additional dollar is worth to you. It's this concept in economics called the marginal utility of money. And the best analogy I can give so people can kind of have an inherent grasp of this is if you think about it, Allison, say that you haven't eaten all day, you skipped breakfast, skipped lunch, breakfast, took a run, you know, worked your whole day, and then you get home and it's 6 o'clock, you're about to chew your arm off, you order a pizza, okay? That first piece of pizza when you were starving, oh my gosh, so good, so cheesy, so delicious. It takes the edge off. The second piece fills you up a little bit more. Maybe you even say, you know what, I'm having a third piece of pizza. Okay. And then you put the rest in the fridge for later. Well, then somebody orders an additional pizza and you think, you know what, that's important too. I can put that in the freezer. I'll have that for a snack in a couple of days. And then someone orders you 1 billion pizzas. That's what I'm talking about, right? If somebody orders you 1 billion pizzas, you have so many pizzas that you have to hire people to help you figure out how to store, you know, and transport those pizzas. That's the same thing with taxes. So if the gross amount of dollars that someone writes out seems significant to you, then think about how little each additional dollar of income means to them. I could hand Jeff Bezos my entire annual salary and it would make literally zero difference whatsoever in any way, shape, or form on anything. So taxing people at that level is entirely the right thing to do.
Yeah, I know. I had tweeted out something about Elon Musk and somebody replied, oh, did you donate $50 million to charity? And I said, you mean 0.00002% of my net worth? Yes.
Exactly.
More, actually.
Yeah. Forgive me if I'm not particularly impressed with the charitable, you know, orientation of the country's billionaires.
Yeah. No. And again, the length of a minute depends on which side of the bathroom door you're on. So I've had a wonderful time talking to you. I think everybody needs to give Richie Neal a call, write him some letters. Especially if you're his constituent, that's when they listen to you the most, if at all. And please, everybody, check out Tax the Rich, How Lies, Loopholes, and Lobbyists Make the Rich Even Richer. Thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it. Erica Payne.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it. This is great.
Awesome. Everybody stick around. We'll be right back. Hey, everybody, it's AG, and this segment of the pod is brought to you by Beanbox. Daily Beans, Beanbox. I love a good morning routine. I like to get up early. I take a shower, go to the gym. And then when I'm done, I like to sit down with my coffee and read the news. And no morning is complete without a cup of coffee. Brewing your daily cup at home is just better. The smell fills the house. It gets the day going right. From that first aroma of ground beans to that very last sip, the ritual of morning coffee helps you start the day more grounded and more centered. Beanbox elevates your coffee ritual even further with a curated selection of world-class coffees delivered right to your door. I love the variety of Beanbox's flavors, and they consistently provide high-quality coffee. It's just so good. And it's across the board. And it's fun opening the box to find a flight of incredible coffees I'd probably never get to taste otherwise. With Beanbox, you get an all-access pass to some of the best artisan coffees in the world, and this makes a great gift, too. No other subscription coffee service offers the same incredible variety and quality, always roasted and delivered at peak flavor. And for an amazing gift to the coffee lover in your life, check out their World Coffee Tour. This is the gift I was telling you about. I've got this for so many people for the holidays. 16 coffees sourced from some of the best coffee-producing regions around the globe. It's the World Coffee Tour. Take a guided tour through some of the best coffees in the world with Beanbox. Order today at beanbox.com/dailybeans. That's so amazing. Get your first tasting box for just $5 with promo code DAILYBEANS, all one word. That's your first monthly tasting box for just $5 when you use promo code DAILYBEANS at beanbox.com/dailybeans. That's a lot of beans. Today's show is also brought to you by my favorite shower, the Nebbia by Moen. You just know I just recently put up pictures. I remodeled my bathroom, right? I ripped everything out. I got rid of everything except one thing. And that was my Moen, my Nebbia by Moen spa shower. It's incredible. It was designed by former Tesla, NASA, and Apple engineers who spent years developing a superior shower experience. It is Nebbia's most advanced shower yet, with twice the coverage but half the water usage. So it only uses 45% less water. It uses 45% less water, but its spray is 81% more powerful than the competition. The atomized droplets rinse shampoo and conditioner out of the thickest hair, and installation is as easy as changing a light bulb. I love my Nebbia. My shower is like my personal spa now. It's refreshing. It's invigorating. The Nebbia by Moen Spa Shower starts at just $199, and for Daily Beans listeners, we have a deal. The first 100 people to use code BEANS at Nebbia.com will get 10% off all Nebbia products. Nebbia rarely does deals like this, so this is a good deal to jump on. Go to Nebbia.com/beans. That's Nebbia, Nebbia.com/beans to check out what they have to offer. And the first 100 people to use code BEANS when checking out will save 10% off all Nebbia products. The only exception, though, is pre-order products, because Nebbia is going to give you free shipping on that in the U.S. Again, that's Nebbia.com/beans and use code BEANS to save 10%. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. Today, we're talking with the Director for Democracy Policy at Indivisible Project, my friend and amazing person, activist, and just all-around wonderful woman. Please welcome Megan Hatcher-Mays. How are you?
I am good. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you back. And you know, we had a robust discussion the last time you were on. And since that time, we've had SB 8 happen to us, at us, right? And I think everyone's aware of the law. But if not, would you just kind of give a brief overview of what SB 8 allows for in the state?
Yes. So the Republicans and the Republican governor in Texas and the Texas state legislature passed this bill called SB 8. It is a kind of a sneaky way to effectively ban abortion in Texas, you know, technically after 6 weeks, but really there's nobody who knows that they're pregnant at 6 weeks unless you're doing IVF. But so it effectively bans abortion in Texas. The way it was written, I noted that it was kind of sneaky. The way it was written was an attempt to try to avoid legal challenges. So the way that it works is instead of a government official or a government agency in Texas enforcing this law, which penalizes abortion providers, people who are seeking abortions, or anybody who might drive you to an abortion or help you pay for an abortion. Instead of having a state agency enforce it, it is written to allow private citizens to enforce the law, which means that if a private citizen, say your neighbor, found out that you got an abortion after 6 weeks, that neighbor could sue you, and they could sue your doctor or sue the person that drove you to the appointment, and they could win in court up to $10,000. So they basically created kind of a bounty hunter situation in Texas for anybody seeking an abortion. Mm-hmm. The reason they did this is because if it's the government that is making it difficult or impossible for you to get an abortion, that would implicate, you know, everything that Roe and subsequent cases after Roe kind of enshrined into law. But if it's a private actor, it's a little bit different. But they did that on purpose so that they, because they felt like it had a better chance for the law to stand if they wrote it that way. And they were right, because the Supreme Court let it go into effect.
Yeah, exactly. If it's the state enforcing the law, then any other entity can sue to block the state from right. doing unconstitutional things. But since they're private actors, however, the Department of Justice did file mm-hmm. a pretty amazing lawsuit. I think it took them about a week and a half to do so. We were all pushing very hard. Mm-hmm. And you know, there has been some arguments about whether they were already going to do it or whether the outrage and backlash mm-hmm. pushed them to do it. But either way, I'm not going to be quiet. So they filed their lawsuit, and it's a brilliant lawsuit. It basically talks about 14th Amendment, Supremacy Clause. They said, we have a lot of federal workers that this impacts, and because federal law usurps state law, this is it violates the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. Plus, it's just unconstitutional because right. every, you know, a person who can get pregnant has a right to seek an abortion. And then they also said, you know, by the way, you're officially kind of deputizing private citizens, which means they're part of the state. Mm-hmm. So that's what gives us the power to bring this suit. And then they also filed shortly after that a request for injunction to block it temporarily while mm-hmm. the lawsuit is being litigated. And then they filed for an expedited hearing schedule. Now, the judge already gave them an expedited hearing schedule, so they denied the additional request for expedition and set a hearing date for October 1st. And what was funny, Megan, is when they denied, when the court was like, no, we've got it for October 1st. We can't do it any faster, so we're denying your additional expediting request. Ken Abbott and Paxton ran with that saying, we mm-hmm. win, you know, and it's like, no, you didn't win.
Right.
But that's just sort of how they operate, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think in a strange way, I think that this is why conservatives love focusing so much on the courts. It's really hard to sometimes explain how these procedural maneuvers work to people who have not gone into a devastating amount of debt to go to law school, such as myself. So that way, you know, Greg Abbott and Ken Paxton can go out and say, oh yeah, we won. And, you know, it freaks everybody out and it's difficult to explain. It's a lot easier to kind of obfuscate what you're doing when you're relying on court decisions and procedural maneuvers to kind of advance your agenda, because it's a lot harder to explain kind of what's going on. And that is why I think conservatives have really thrown their weight behind kind of reshaping the judiciary for the last 50 years or so, because it's a lot easier to hide kind of your dirty deeds when you go that route, as opposed to being politically accountable for the bad stuff that you do in say Congress, by contrast.
Yeah. And then recently we also had a doctor who came out and said, I performed an abortion on the 6th of September after this law went into effect. I did it. Mm-hmm. It was after 6 weeks. And it's been hit with the first test, right, of this right. lawsuit. And Steve Vladek has said, even if you test this one at a time, you can only test this law one at a time. You know, if this person loses, the person who's suing this doctor, this provider, for, you know, for $10,000 or whatever, plus damages, which are unlimited, and loses, which they likely will, that doesn't enjoin anyone else from bringing lawsuits. Do you know what I mean? Like, that won't set the precedent, because these are private civil suits. You can't set a legal precedent and overturn a law on a civil suit. People can just keep bringing the civil suits and losing.
Yeah, I think if I were in that doctor's position, well, it's been many years since I have thought about actual litigation, but I suspect, you know, he could argue in court well, this shouldn't apply because the law is unconstitutional. Like at the basis of this law is not constitutional, and therefore they should not succeed in the civil suit. But, you know, Steve Waddick obviously knows a lot more about this than I do. But the unfortunate thing is, you know, this is all happening because, you know, one of the reasons that the Supreme Court gave why they weren't going to block the law from going into effect is because they didn't think there had yet to be anyone harmed by it. So there wasn't anybody that had standing because, as we were talking about before, because the state isn't the one that's enforcing it, there's nobody that the abortion providers could sue at the state level to block this law from going into effect. And because there had been no lawsuits yet, there wasn't a person either. So now there is a person. So that's good. But it shouldn't have ever gotten to this point. The Supreme Court very obviously should have found a way to block this law from going into effect. It's profoundly unconstitutional. But to your point, it's very good that the Department of Justice jumped in when they did and basically said, well, as the United States Department of Justice, we have an interest in protecting the constitutional rights of the people that live in this country. So it's very good that they jumped in when they did.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, Megan, all of this might be completely moot because the Supreme Court has decided to take up the Mississippi 15-week case and hear arguments in the fall. And I want to talk to you a little bit about our bigger problems, but I have to take a quick break. Will you stay with me?
Of course.
Awesome. Everybody stay around. We'll be right back. Everybody, it's AG for the Daily Beans. And this portion of the show is brought to you by Glamnetic. Get rid of the lash glue for good. Okay. Meet Glamnetic, the world's first 6-magnet lash made for easy application and all day hold. Glamnetic has sold over 500,000 pairs of lashes in 2020. So I hopped on the train. I had to try them out for myself. All you have to do is take their quiz, find the perfect lash for your unique eye shape and style. It takes under a minute to apply with no toxic glue and no struggle. I'm telling you, magnetic lashes are the way to go. Up to 60 uses per lash, so they're more eco-friendly and they're wallet-friendly. With over 75 styles for your perfect fit, from natural to full glam, you get a different lash for every mood and every occasion. You can take their lash quiz or use the lash guide to find the style that suits you best. Plus, they have vegan and cruelty-free options available. Over 500,000 happy customers can't be wrong, and they have a 100% money-back guarantee with expedited shipping and free shipping in the U.S. and Canada on orders over $30. Find out for yourself why Glamnetic lashes are Instagram's favorite beauty hack. Go to glamnetic.com/beans, enter promo code beans for 30% off your order. This code is only available for you. That's glamnetic.com/beans and enter promo code beans at checkout for 30% off. I promise you guys, these lashes literally apply themselves. They're awesome. And today's show is also brought to you by Upstart. I know if you have high interest credit card debt, you make those minimum payments and nothing happens. It just stays the same. It's this endless cycle. But you can make the final payment with Upstart and take control of your debt. It's easy to pay off your debt with an online personal loan with Upstart. Over 1 million people have used Upstart to consolidate high interest debt and pay off their credit cards or fund personal expenses with a fixed monthly payment. Upstart looks beyond your credit score to find you a better loan rate by considering other factors like your income and your job and your credit history. You can check your rate without impacting your credit score in minutes online for loans between $1,000 to $50,000. And once your loan is accepted, you can receive your funds in as fast as one business day. So that's go to upstart.com/dailybeans. That's upstart.com/dailybeans. And please use our URL to let them know we sent you. Your loan amount will be determined based on your credit, income, and other certain information provided in your loan application. Again, that's upstart.com/dailybeans. Everybody, welcome back. We are talking with the Director for Democracy Policy at Indivisible Project, Megan Hatcher-Mays. Before the break, you know, we were talking about, hey, you know, we might have a lot of chances here to subvert and or stop or enjoin SB 8, like stop it from happening. The hearing's going to be October 1st. I'm assuming we'll either on the first go around or on appeal get some kind of a stay or an injunction stopping the law from going into effect while we wait for the Department of Justice's lawsuit and all the amicus briefs to be litigated. The problem is we've got another case out of Mississippi, which is a 15-week ban, which seeks to gut Roe v. Wade completely at the federal level, whereas the SB 8 was just sort of they let a law go into effect that basically guts Roe, but can be stopped. This one would change the face of it if successful. And we've just found out they're going to hear the case and they're going to hear arguments. And I can't see how a majority Federalist Society court wouldn't at least, at the very least, say that states can decide what week to ban abortion, which would effectively gut Roe. And I was wondering, What do we do about that now? Because now we've got this giant, looming, massive threat on the horizon.
Yeah, absolutely. This is very scary. And I think this is what, you know, activists have been warning about for years. Like, this was the whole conservative project, was to stack the court with as many, you know, anti-choice justices as they could get. And right now they have six. That's why they were all picked. I think the Federalist Society, I mean, folks should know, the Federalist Society only came into being after Roe v. Wade. And it was because of that case that they exist. They wanted, they looked around and kind of saw that, the courts are granting civil and constitutional rights to women and Black people and people of color. And we don't like that. We like having hoarding power for a small group of wealthy white elites. And we can't have the court kind of undoing centuries of of our own power existing. So they created the Federalist Society, and they were like, and they thought to themselves, well, we can't just come right out and say we're doing this because we're racist and misogynist. We have to think of a nice way to say it. So they came up with the concept called called originalism. The concept of originalism is only as old as me. I'm only 39 or so. So it's just a nice way of saying, well, you know, if it's not in the original text of the Constitution, then the framers didn't intend for it to be true. Which is another way of saying, we do not want women, people of color, Black people to have civil and constitutional rights that are not explicitly named in the Constitution. Although, of course, Trump eventually came along and they just dropped the pretext, but at least at the time, they thought they had to be nice about it. So that's how we ended up where we are. Now we have six extremely conservative Supreme Court justices, and it's not just kind of a passing objection that I have with them and their ideology. They're very scary people. Amy Coney Barrett in particular is very scary, very, very anti-choice. She had signed on to an ad basically calling abortion murder. And she just has a lot of really scary and outside the mainstream views on reproductive justice and reproductive healthcare. Same is true for Brett Kavanaugh, Neil Gorsuch, and the rest. So we're in a situation where you are absolutely right. It's not looking good for Roe v. Wade. Now, they might not come right out and say, we hereby overturn Roe v. Wade. But to your point, they absolutely will. They actually can effectively gut it by saying, well, the states can set whatever limits they want on reproductive health care entirely, which means that states like Mississippi could drop it from 15 to 6 or from 15 mm-hmm. weeks to 0 weeks or, you know, whatever the case may be. So we on the left need to start thinking of ways that we can kind of remove the court from these sort of critical issues. And it's not just abortion, but it's immigration and economic justice and all of that.
Yep.
And one way to do that is to add seats, is to expand the Supreme Court by at least four justices, which would make up for the three bonkers people that Donald Trump was able to confirm and kind of get the court back on track.
It's not just to make up for the three bonkers people to do either, right? Because we have 13
That's right.
appellate court circuits.
Yeah.
And there are, you know, each circuit court gets a judge, a justice assigned to them for administrative things, and they don't have enough. And so we should have at least a judge for every circuit court.
That's right. Yeah. The number nine, it's not set in stone. It's not in the Constitution, but that number exists because there used to be
nine
circuits, but now there are more than that. There are 13. So there should be at least one justice for that. But I think we're basically at a point right now where the Supreme Court's popularity is at an all-time low. And the reason for that is because they are really implicating themselves in really very serious social justice issues in a way that a supposed apolitical body should not be doing. And they're acting very much like a partisan institution and a political institution, as opposed to sort of dispassionate judges who care about upholding the rule of law. So when people lose faith in the Supreme Court as an institution, that means they lose faith in, you know, the force of the decisions that of the rulings that they issue. And when that's the case, you really need to look around and do something about restoring balance, restoring integrity to the court that is very central to people's lives. So to your point, yes, there's like a very, you know, obvious reason why we should add seats because of the circuits, but also people deserve to have faith in the Supreme Court too. And right now they don't because of the people that sit on the bench. And there's a way to fix that too. Like, it's a moral issue, I think, to add the seats.
Yeah. And yeah, right now, like you said, the Supreme Court approval rating, according to a Gallup poll on Thursday, dropped to 40%. It was conducted from September 1 through 17. That's about the time they declined to block SB8. And 53% disapprove of the Supreme Court. It hasn't been this low since 2001. And then, 2005 and 2017, it was at 42%. mm-hmm. Which is a little higher than it is now. In 2020, they were at 49%. That's a drop of 10 points within the span of just a couple of months. It's never gone down that far. So you're right. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the problems we're facing, though, Megan, as you know, is in order to add seats to the Supreme Court or in order to codify Roe, we need 60 votes.
That's right.
No, so we're kind of everything sort of seems every conversation I've had in the last, 9 months as we're trying to repair the damage done by the former administration always boils back down to we have to get rid of the filibuster.
Yeah, we do. We need to get rid of the filibuster, restore voting rights as a first step. Well, we might want to address the debt ceiling as well, but, we really need to, the Democrats have a majority and it might only be 50, but it's still a majority. And the American people who delivered them that majority worked really hard to get it to them, and they should be using it. And they should be using it at least as ruthlessly as Mitch McConnell did in the first few years of Trump's presidency.
And if they don't, I'm afraid that that's going to bode very poorly for Democrats in 2022.
Yes.
And not me and not you, but there's going to be so many people who are like, I busted my ass to get a majority. And it's like, I don't have it. Why bother? Please don't think that, anyone. But that's going to be very, not everybody is you or I or the folks who listen to these programs who are going to be plugged in and who are going to do the work. But it's going to make our job that much harder if the Dems just kind of roll over on this. And I don't know what to do about that. There's, what do I do?
Yeah, it's very hard. It's very hard to kind of keep running your car into the same wall every day. And the wall is shaped like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema every day. And that's very, very challenging. Ultimately, though, just like every elected official, senators Manchin and Sinema are preoccupied with their public perception and they're preoccupied with what their legacy will be. And so ultimately it will come down to them deciding, where do I want my photo in the history books? Do I want it to be next to Mitch McConnell as the people that helped him kind of erode our democracy to the point that people couldn't participate in it anymore? Or do I want to be on the side that restored voting rights and that made it easier for people to vote? And at least in the context of voting rights, Manchin himself wrote this new compromise bill that is based on the For the People Act. It would be very weird indeed if he spent all summer writing this bill just to say, actually, I don't want to pass my own piece of legislation because of the filibuster. So I know he's said lots of different things about the filibuster. He at least has said positive stuff about restoring the talking filibuster, which would actually force senators to go down to the floor and talk instead of just... Instead of just emailing an objection down to the floor, they actually have to go down and talk. And once you get to an up or down vote on this bill, the Freedom to Vote Act, I think it would pass. I think we have all 50 Democrats in support. The issue is getting past the filibuster, which I'm really hoping Senate Democrats are going to start to have a very real and visceral sort of existential question conversations about over the next few weeks.
Yeah.
When it comes to court expansion, it's going to be an uphill battle. There's only one sponsor of the bill in the Senate. And it's one of those things where we on the left know it's going to be difficult. We know it's going to be hard, but that doesn't mean we're going to do nothing for the next 2 years. We're going to work really hard to move support for this bill because our democracy really depends on having a functional Supreme Court.
Yeah, 100%. I just, it's right now seeming impossible to raise the debt ceiling and pay our bills. It's seeming impossible to pass a $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation package that would only require Democrats and doesn't even need to get rid of the filibuster. Everything is an uphill battle. And those codifying Roe, adding seats to the court, those are way bigger battles. Mm-hmm. But every single one matters. Getting this budget passed is incredibly important in 2022 as well, because we need this administration to deliver on their campaign promises. And Democrats, I don't think they're going to, I think they'll figure out a way to get these things passed, because they all have to run for office as well. And their seats are on the line. And, I just want to remind everybody that we're going to be pushing so hard to get more seats in the Senate in 2022 so that we can make Manchin and Sinema irrelevant. We can make their votes irrelevant. But I just want to put out a word there that once we get that done, everything won't be easy after that. Like we thought if we just got the Senate, if we got Ossoff and Warnock and we elected Biden, we'd be done and everything would be easy. And that's clearly not the case. And I just want to let everybody know, every single step we take, every single thing we chip away at, doesn't mean we're done. Doesn't mean we've reached the finish line. We haven't crossed a goal line and we don't get to spike the football. We have to keep working. And every election going forward is going to be more important than the last. And I want to thank you, Megan, and Indivisible for everything that you do to ensure that we get everybody out to vote that we can. And can you share with everybody how they can help, how they can get involved, how they can help push? Because this is a full contact sport. It is a participation thing. And we can't stop just because we've won an election or we've elected somebody that we worked really hard to elect.
Yeah, of course. I mean, the best place to go is to our website, indivisible.org, and you can find all of the stuff that we're working on. So not just democracy, but we have a whole team working on this reconciliation and recovery package that we really need to get through. So you can go to our website, indivisible.org, to find out more about that. And then we're also a member of a coalition called Unrig the Courts, which has a whole platform of different court reforms that we're pushing. But most importantly, out of all of them, as I've said, is adding seats to the Supreme Court. So if folks are curious about court reform, in particular Supreme Court expansion, they can go to unrigthecourts.org and you can learn all about our policy platform there, because the courts are a very hot mess, as we have discussed here today.
Yeah, and I know you guys are also working on the federal bench too, not just SCOTUS, but just all the courts. And I think that's so very important, and there's so much important work to be done. And so if you've got a minute, check it out, Unrig the Courts, and I appreciate your time today. Is there anything else you want to talk about before we get out of here, Megan?
Oh, I could talk about democracy all day, but I think I'll leave it there. But thank you so much for having me today.
No, it's been great. And we'll check back with you after that October 1st hearing, and we'll see how SB8 is going. I'd love to have you back on.
I'm there.
Thank you. Megan Hatcher-Mays. Everyone, I hope you enjoyed the show today. Thanks to Erica Payne, author of Tax the Rich. Get that book. It's so good. And of course, our friend Megan Hatcher-Mays. It's been wonderful. Until tomorrow, we'll have another couple great guests. Actually, we have one very good surprise guest tomorrow. You're going to love it. Until then, please take care of yourselves. Take care of the planet. Take care of your mental health. And take care of each other? Did I get those out of order? Whatever, I'm on vacation. This is AG, and them's the Beans. The Daily Beans is written and executive produced by Allison Gill, with additional research and reporting by Dana Goldberg and Amy Carrero. Sound design and editing is by Desiree McFarlane, with art and web design by Joelle Reeder with Moxie Design Studios. Music for The Daily Beans is written and performed by They Might Be Giants, and the show is a proud member of the MSW Media Network, a collection of creator-owned podcasts dedicated to news, politics, and justice. For more information, please visit mswmedia.com.